At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Emmy Brunner. Emmy is a personal empowerment and transformation coach, psychotherapist, hypnotherapist, and the CEO of The Recover Clinic. Through Emmy's personal and professional experience, Emmy works with clients to establish their trauma response and to help them develop coping mechanisms to manage difficult life events. Emmy joins us today to discuss unprocessed trauma and how this can lead to mental health difficulties, including eating disorders. Hello, Emmy.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's lovely to meet you. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Really good.
Good, good. What's the weather like with you? Because this morning with me, it was so warm and windy, and now it's freezing.
It's pretty grim. It's really windy here. I'm on the seafront, so.
Oh, nice.
When it's like a little bit breezy everywhere else, it is like gale force winds down here.
So. I take it you're staying indoors today then, so you don't get blown away.
Exactly, yeah.
Amazing. Well, hopefully, being indoors, you'll be fine. So I wanted to start today by kind of getting an understanding of what your personal experience has been and how that has led to the role that you now do. So I wondered if you'd mind walking us through that, please.
Yeah, sure. So I think from a really young age, I struggled with eating disorders and other mental health issues that now have more formal diagnosis than they would have done when I was a kid, but very generalized anxiety and depression as well, and self-harm behaviors. And I didn't really have any structured help. My GP and the kind of NHS route wasn't very helpful for me, and I saw general therapists, and again, none of it was very directive or helpful. And so I started doing a lot of my own reading, and this all took years of me struggling, doing a little bit better, struggling again, but did a lot of my own reading into really how I was going to have any sort of sustained recovery. And I came to sort of understand that actually, rather than focusing on my relationship with food or my body or whatever else it was, my other anxieties I might have had, it was about thinking about the relationship that I had with myself. And then I later on went on to start to work with other people with eating disorders. And there was something really obvious to me about the way treatment was focused on an abstinence-based model, so an abstinence from behaviours. And it felt to me that actually everyone had developed all these coping strategies to try and manage the difficult things in their lives. And then the solution to that was to just try and take them away, but not necessarily replace them with anything. And that just seemed really counterintuitive, but more than that, it wasn't working for lots of people. And the recovery rates were really, really low in facilities that were structured like that. So I set up my own therapy service where we focused more on developing a compassionate relationship with yourself, where you were able to kind of forgive yourself, work on a lot of the shame that you felt, unpack where appropriate some of the trauma that you've maybe been through, and use a community to gain a sense of strength and self-worth that wasn't focused on trying not to act out on your eating disorder or trying not to act out on your self-harm behaviors, but really more of a harm minimization approach, where the eating disorder essentially became redundant, like it was no longer serving a purpose. And that worked, and that was really successful. So since then, I've gone on to work less in a therapeutic context and more in a coaching context, because it's, I'm able to be a lot more directive with my work, which I find more interesting and useful for the people that I work with. And I do a lot of focused coaching now on helping people to put in some tangible tools rather than general therapy that can go on for a long time. I try and give people really practical things that they can do to instantly start to change things and see a shift in how they feel. Yeah. And that's where we are today.
Sounds brilliant. It's something that I think has been in discussion a lot more. I mean, I've noticed a lot more recently, and something I've been thinking about, in the sense of when you go for, you know, more stereotypical eating disorder treatment, it is all focused on weight, body, shape, food, and it's not looking at the kind of underneath of that. And so I think it sounds fantastic that you're going to, you know, for me, the eating disorder is just sort of a vehicle to sort of say something's not quite right here. And also, you know, I'm using this as like a, like you said, a way of coping. But, you know, in my personal experience, if I don't have the eating disorder, I just have something else that's maladaptive. It's not the, so it's not necessarily just the food. It's just the food is a way of being like, hi, something's wrong.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think when it is all focused on body and food, you really miss the person within that, like who they are, their story, what matters to them, what doesn't matter, you know, and it becomes all about trying to get them to a certain weight or stop acting in a certain way. And you really miss the point, because actually, like you said, those behaviours will just reinforce in some other area of that person's life. And actually, if you don't address that core wound, then that person's going to remain stuck in some sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you work with your clients, it sounds like you have a very like patient, a very client focused approach with trying to understand who they are, what they like, what they don't like. Do you always use the same sort of method to work out what they should sort of replace the eating disorder with, the new coping mechanisms, does it depend depending on the person?
You know what, I think it's good that you said patient, because I think it is patient, like I think that's the reason you said that. So I think it is a much more patient model of recognizing that actually you can't kind of force somebody to do something and 6 weeks go, right, on you go, you know, on your way, you'll be all right sort of thing. I think it's about having a more sustained and gradual sense of healing that comes from the outside in. And I think as long as somebody is physically stable to do that work, then actually what you want to see is that change happening internally and resulting in external shifts, not the other way around. I think when people are forced to kind of exist in bodies that they find very difficult to be in, it's almost re-traumatizing people again and again, which is what people experience going into residential treatment, for sure, that they get traumatized and re-traumatized. And actually, when you start to have relationships with people, I think that's where the healing lies.
Yeah, definitely. I think that kind of idea of you know, the trauma around the weight gain, often in services, it, you know, and I think sometimes it does need to be quick to get somebody out of a medically compromised situation. But a lot of the time, I think it does happen quite quickly. People aren't given the tools to navigate that. And, you know, obviously, we said it's not all about weight and shape, but there is still an element of that. And that process can be, you know, traumatizing for patients. And that's what we were kind of going to talk about today, was the aspect of trauma and how you bring that into your work. So I think the word trauma can sometimes be misunderstood. So I kind of just wanted you to explain, what does it mean for you?
I think trauma is something that we all experience as human beings. It's part of the nature of being human that we go through difficult life experiences that impact us. Mm-hmm. So the question isn't really whether we have trauma. We all have trauma. The question is, how does that trauma impact me, and what are my tools and resources to cope when it does? So I think that's a really important starting point. Mm-hmm. And it can be an uncomfortable place to think about what trauma you have and how it's impacted you. But I think it's really important to sort of own your truth, like own your story. Because so often, and particularly with eating disorders treatment, as we've said, it does become about other things. And It's really important that you, if you're struggling, feel seen and heard, and most of all by yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think the eating disorder and the way that it operates, it really eclipses a sufferer and really makes it difficult for people to see them beyond that diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So as a starting point, I think it's really important that the people that I work with understand that that is one thing that they're struggling with. I don't see that as the entirety of their identity mm-hmm. and who they are.
Yeah. I mean, and that is so important, because I think so often your identity when you're diagnosed with an eating disorder can become the eating disorder. You know, it takes up such a large proportion of your thinking, your mm-hmm. actions, your time. You know, at some stages when I was struggling, it almost felt like a hobby because it was the only thing yeah. that I did. So to unpack yeah. all of that is hard.
Yeah, it becomes very habitual, I think, in its mm. nature. But you're told that you are anorexic and you are mm-hmm. bulimic, not you have. And that's it's a really strange language to use for an illness that is temporary and something that you've developed as a set of behaviours. And it's almost the way that that phrasing is articulated, it makes it difficult for people not to merge with the identity of it. And because it is so all-encompassing, it's part of your life and how you're managing, it just reinforces a lot of that.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting actually, because I was like reading a thread on Twitter the other day that was talking about language about eating disorders, and they said that they tried really hard to not use words like anorexia or bulimia specifically, and they'd say eating disorder, because you'd never say to someone you're eating disorderic, mm-hmm. but people tend to say anorexic. And I mean, why do you think people use that terminology? Do you think it's because people don't necessarily see it as recoverable, or is it just something that people have slipped into?
I think partly it's the stigma around mental health conditions, where we're viewing them as things that we need to try and manage rather than things that we can fully recover from, that actually they're responses to difficult life events that we need to heal from. That's not how it's seen. It's seen as this is something that you do, that you have, that, you know, that needs to be controlled and managed. And that whole mentality, I think, for anyone who struggles with an eating disorder, that battle of control is such a complicated one anyway. And I think, you know, it almost annoys when people talk about control and eating disorders, because it's quite predictable. But I think it's more than just trying to control everything around you. I think it's trying to control people's perception of you, because you are so immersed in shame that we cannot bear to be seen. And I think what happens when you have an illness, particularly like anorexia, because it's physically so evident, is that we are no longer seen. That is what is seen. And it makes it easier for us to hide, which is why I think my commitment as a clinician is to make sure that people know that I see them beyond that. It's so important, because as much as we want to hide, we do want to be seen too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I especially think, you know, when you go into a treatment facility, even if you know 99.9% of you thinks you don't want to be there, there's still that 0.1% that is there for mm-hmm. some reason, mm-hmm. and that really shouts to me that you do want to be seen. Mm-hmm. So how do you help a client to be seen? You know, if they're completely consumed by their eating disorder, how would you start to pick out what's them and what's the eating disorder?
I think being curious about who they are is really important. So one of the things that we'll talk about is with a client who is very much used to talking about their eating disorder and food and how they feel about that, is almost to kind of take a complete disinterest in that and to have a complete focus on who they are, whether that's like, what did they like to do when they were younger? What were they interested in being when they grew up? What kind of jobs were they interested in? Why did they pick those studies that they did at university? Like, really kind of strengthening a dialogue that is absolutely nothing to do with it, because when you have an eating disorder, that's what people talk about a lot. Mm-hmm. And in the treatment context, that's all people talk about, is your eating disorder, with this sense of, yeah, even your eating disorder I feel uncomfortable with, like it's belonging to you somehow, and how you feel about that and how you feel about the food. And I think the gift with anybody being seen or heard is knowing that somebody is interested in them and who they are. And I think the more you can help them to strengthen a narrative that is completely separate from that, the more resilient people become.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, overall in the long term, being able to have that separation between who the person is and who the eating disorder is, that to me feels something really important in recovery, to be able to separate those, because often they can feel so entwined. And I think, like you've said, you do, people do often feel like they sort of lost themselves within that, and within the eating disorder. Do you have any strategies that you use to sort of really identify? Because I know personally, for me, there's times where I'm like, I don't know whether I'm doing this because I want to or because I feel like the eating disorder wants to.
Yeah, I think when you've suffered in the past, I think you always have a level of like vigilance when it comes to thoughts around body and food that you perhaps wouldn't have if you hadn't suffered. So I think that's part of the fallout of the trauma of having an illness like that. But I think a lot of it is helping people to recognize that those thoughts that they have, maybe about food, are really metaphors for other things. If you're somebody who struggles with anorexia and you restrict your food, then you also restrict your social interactions. You also restrict the amount of fun that you have. You probably don't enjoy sex. You probably don't. You restrict lots of things in your life. It's not just about food. And I always think like the biggest trick an eating disorder ever played was making everybody think it was about food, because it's not just about food. That's what makes the most noise. It's what gets most attention because of the medical kind of complications around it. But actually, it's impacting every area of your life. And if you can start to be curious about that as a sufferer and think, actually, what's this about? Why am I feeling like I need to deprive myself? Why am I feeling like I'm not worthy or deserving? Then actually you start to unpack something that's far more interesting for a person. They're far more curious about than how do you feel if you eat, I don't know, carbs.
Yeah.
Something like that. I think it's just, I mean, it's so missing the point. But I think, yeah, trying to get somebody to be curious about the origins of their self-loathing, I think, is absolutely key. And not being focused on how the eating disorder is presenting, because somebody who is bulimic in their presentation or they binge eat in their presentation has very similar thought patterns to somebody with anorexia. Somebody who binge eats will often restrict very heavily as well, but because they're seen differently, people treat them differently, and it's really wrong.
Yeah. I think I've always kind of, well, not always, but I think I've started to realise that actually the kind of the underneath that we keep mentioning is it tends to be really similar. People are looking for a way to cope. But like you said, because the maybe presentation has different characteristics, it's judged differently, it's kind of approached differently. But actually getting to that underneath could be a similar approach.
Yeah, totally. When you make the person the focus of the treatment rather than the diagnosis, that's when people start to get better, because then you're building a relationship with a person where you're helping them to uncover the truth of what it is they're dealing with.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You mentioned when you were just talking there about self-loathing and trying to understand kind of why that comes about and how that might link to eating disorder. Do you think that sometimes, or maybe all the time or never, that self-loathing is kind of comes from trauma, or is there other things that can contribute to that?
No, I think that comes from trauma. I think I don't think any of us are born thinking that way about ourselves. We're born feeling joyful and adoring of the people around us in the world, and it's our life experiences that impact how we view ourselves. I'll always ask my clients, what's the story you're telling yourself about who you are and your place in the world? Because it is a story. And once you can identify that, thinking about where's that story come from? Is it something that has arisen out of an experience that you had? Is it something you were told? Is it a combination of things? Like, be curious about it. And understanding that actually our worlds are just a manifestation about what we believe about ourselves to be true. That's it. So if actually what you're experiencing isn't something you like, then the story you're telling yourself is creating that. So the goal is to change the story, to change how you're seeing yourself. Be curious about where that's come from. Yeah.
So when I first sort of when I first put together this episode and kind of was asking you questions, in my mind, when I was thinking about like unprocessed trauma and stuff like that, I was thinking about big events that might have happened to people and having to work through those. But the more I speak to you, it's kind of feeling like the unprocessed trauma that you need to work through isn't necessarily, you know, working through big events that happened and how that made you feel, but more the beliefs that have developed about yourself from, you know, big, small, whatever mm-hmm. events mm-hmm. and unpacking those to mm-hmm. go forwards. Is that, yeah. am I getting the right gist?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think because we can go through kind of big traumas and actually human beings are really resilient. We're able to heal. We're able to respond to really difficult life events and recover from them if we have the tools, if we have the tools. Those of us that don't have the tools can get stuck and we can get find ourselves in a place where we're searching for other ways to cope. So for me, growing up with the traumas that I had, some of them big, some of them smaller, the strategies that I had were really limited. So I developed other ways of coping. It's like self-harm. Self-harm isn't there because we're trying to harm ourselves. Self-harm is there because we're trying to make things feel better, which you can only ever understand if you've self-harmed, right? If you don't, that can sound quite confusing. But it's there as a kind of way of trying to manage and cope with your emotions and how you feel.
And I think that is, it's something that I always try to kind of explain to people, but it's, like you say, it's so difficult to explain when you're not in the situation. You know, I do personally see an eating disorder as a form of self-harm. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, I'll speak to my mum about it or something and she'll be like, but why, you know, you can see that you're hurting yourself. Why can't you just eat? And it's hard to break it down because...
Yeah, but what's the answer? Because I want to hurt myself.
Mm, yeah.
So there you go. It's pretty simple. It's just not what people want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, I know. I want to hurt myself. Now, why do you want to hurt yourself? That's the question. Because whatever your answer might be, mine would have been because I feel undeserving. I feel unlovable. I feel ashamed for existing. I feel ashamed for wanting things. For needing things, for wanting food. I'm embarrassed about wanting food. Yeah, that's the answer to the question. You have to ask the right questions to get the real answers. Some people don't. I was going to say because they don't know. That's not criticism. It's more mm-hmm. observational.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess when somebody's in that caring position, you know, a loved one or family, mm-hmm. your friend or whatever, for them to hear you say, well, yes, mm-hmm. I don't want to hurt myself. Then that's really difficult to acknowledge and to hear as well.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I think as a sufferer, you don't necessarily want to share that with somebody that you care about because you don't want to hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you understand you're hurting them, you don't want to share that truth because it's bleak and it's painful to acknowledge. It's painful for us to acknowledge when we feel it, you know, let alone the people around us that care about us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So how do you... reframe that with people, you know, if somebody, let's use the example of if somebody just want to kind of harm themselves because they feel unloved, undeserving, mm-hmm. how do you unpack that to then make it, because you said at the start, you know, it's about getting comfortable with yourself and building that relationship mm-hmm. with yourself, which mm-hmm. sounds lovely, but it sounds mm-hmm. tough.
Mm-hmm. I think part of it is thinking it's almost kind of taking it back always. Why do you feel undeserving and unloved? Let's be curious about it. Let's, you and I, I'm not trying to fix it. I'm actually sitting here in the darkness with you and I'm not trying to pull you out of it. I want you to tell me why. I want to understand. And I think that is definitely a different place to be with somebody with an eating disorder, because what happens when eating disorders get challenged is that us as sufferers, we move to protect the eating disorder. That's kind of the nature of the beast, because it feels threatened, and it feels threatened because someone's challenging our strategies for coping and we can't cope. So when somebody doesn't challenge it, when somebody is very gentle in their approach, and I would always say, used to say to clients coming into clinic, you don't need to gain weight. Can you just not lose weight? Can we just stabilize you for a bit? And as soon as you do that, that kind of fight for protecting the eating disorder is diminished even slightly, to go, let's just keep everything on an even keel for a bit. As long as someone's medically stable, let's just keep them stable, because it gives you time then to build a relationship with a person. And in the same, creating time and space where you can start to talk and share, rather than it being about trying to get rid of the eating disorder. And by the way, you shouldn't feel like that. You should feel deserving. You should feel loved. It's like, well, great, but I don't. Mm-hmm. So let's work with the truth. And I think it's very difficult for people, family members, to sit in that darkness with the person that they love, really hard. But it's not for clinicians, or it shouldn't be, I think. For us, I think that's our job, to sit in that darkness, and just then that person's not alone there. They might still be there, but they're not by themselves anymore.
Yeah. I really like the sound of that approach, because I think, like you've said, often when you know, when the eating disorder is challenged, the sufferer will withdraw and try and protect their eating disorder, because mm-hmm. that's how it happens. And I think often because of that, that it can then become like sufferer and eating disorder and clinician on the other side, mm-hmm. and it's a mm-hmm. battle then between the two. Mm-hmm. But the approach that you have sounds much more like you're coming, you know, into the darkness with the sufferer. The eating disorder is still there. But trying to unpick the sufferer from the eating disorder so that they can, like we said before, try and establish who they are themselves.
Yeah, and like you've articulated it really well. It's about then you're on the same team.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're on the same team. You're going, this must be really hard for you to feel that way and for you to have to rely on this eating disorder. Mm-hmm. Why don't we see if we can introduce some other things that might be helpful for you? And someone goes, okay, because it's not about the eating disorder anymore. Mm-hmm. You're bringing stuff in, you're not taking things away.
Mm. Yeah. And I really like that idea of what you said closer to the start about the eating disorder just becomes redundant. And that to me sounds like such a long-term method towards mm-hmm. it, of the eating disorder becomes redundant rather than ripping it away, because mm-hmm. you know, naturally anybody that gets something taken away from them, they want it back. Like it's not their yeah. choice.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think as well, it feels like it kind of, that level of recovery sort of creeps up on you then. You suddenly mm. realise you're not motivated to act out in the same way. You suddenly don't want to harm yourself anymore because you care about yourself. And you didn't see it coming. You didn't realise when it happened, but it did. Mm. And then things start to change. And I think that what happens with people with eating disorders is their softness comes in. You know, there's such a sort of defended place of being when you're in struggle, and when you allow sort of a bit of softness to come in and a bit of vulnerability, that's when things really start to, the magic happens.
Mm. Yeah. Something that I was just thinking about then when you said softness was, and maybe it's not the same for everybody, but I guess I just wanted to see what you thought about sort of the approach, because I think sometimes when people are in eating sort of recovery, they can try and tiptoe around it and have mm-hmm. like a gentle approach, or other times people come in all guns blazing and it's like taking no, you know, taking no shit, this is how it's being done. Do you think there's a better way to do it, or does it depend on the person?
I think the only way to do it is by building a relationship with the person. I think obviously is, and this is all within the context of somebody being medically stable, you know, mm-hmm. if somebody's really vulnerable and they need to be refed because they're not able to have the clarity of mind to make those decisions, then that there's a different argument for that. But I think if somebody is medically stable, then no, I think slowly is always the way.
Mm.
I think as well, you know, thinking about if you're hurt and something is painful, or even as a child, you don't need picking up, pulling together, being shouted at and going, right, we're going to mend this now. We're going to do it right now. And you're going to do exactly what I tell you. You want someone soft to go, it's okay. It hurts. I know. Let's make it better. Come on. That's what we want. It's what we all want. And it never changes. It's what we all want. We want nurture. And it's that kind of soft feminine energy that we need to move toward, because we're stuck in that very defended masculine energy when we're in struggle. And it's what makes us feel vulnerable. It's why we find it difficult to admit we have needs and that we want that. We want that nurture. We want that softness. But there's no shame in that. That's what it is to be human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, when you put it like that, say, would you rather be just picked up and said, come on, we're going to fix it? Or gently, you know, walking through it, it definitely makes sense. I think sometimes I just feel like I guess it's not slowly processing it. Maybe more what I'm thinking is when it's maladaptive to be so soft, it almost gives the eating sort of too much space because you're just kind of treading on eggshells and avoiding the difficult questions. But I guess, you know, thinking about it out loud, you can still do that slowly, gentle approach, yeah, but not avoid those.
There's a difference in being avoidant. Mm-hmm. Going, oh, I'm just taking my time, and yeah, actually not engaging and being avoidant. But you can't be in relationship and do that. Mm-hmm. So if you're in relationship with somebody and you're showing up for somebody, then that feels very different. And you can always tell when somebody's not really connected in relationship with you as a clinician. So I think the softly approach doesn't necessarily mean that you can't be firm and you can't be directive. I think you can certainly be those things, but it's got to be in collaboration with the person you're working with. Mm. You know, you can't drag people through it by their hair. It doesn't work like that, I don't think.
No, definitely not. And I think if you do, then that just builds up the barrier even more to wanting to recover. How would you work with somebody, you know, because I feel like a lot of people will, it's like I said before, they might have that 99.9% of them that doesn't think they want to get better, but that 0.1% is tying up. So how would you get it to a point with a patient that they can actually start to, you know, contribute more and build that relationship with you rather than hanging on? Is it like an ongoing process throughout?
Yes, an ongoing process, and you'd be amazed what you achieve with just kindness, you know. Mm-hmm. Just be kind to people and take your time and invest in them. And I think offer something of yourself in a relationship like you would any other. I think that idea of having a therapist who's really opaque and sort of monosyllabic and not very engaged is not something that people find very helpful. Mm. I think having somebody who's really prepared to be in relationship with you and care about you, I think is really powerful. And it's what makes all the difference. I think the best clinicians I know just are all heart, you know, all heart, and really able to invest something in their clients that you can't teach or learn. It's just in them. And I think that's what takes you from that 0.1% to 3%, 5%, 10%, 20%, you know, slowly.
How do you, in the sense of building that relationship as a clinician, you know, and maybe this is my personality type, which is why I'm not a clinician, but I always find it interesting, you know, building that relationship and then letting somebody go.
It's a bit bittersweet. So, yeah, when somebody doesn't need you anymore, it means you've done a good job, but it means they don't need you anymore and you have to let them go. That's part of the deal.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I've been really lucky with some of the clients that I've had over the years. I've stayed in touch with clients for years. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite clients who struggled so much is now a clinician, or loads of them are clinicians, but one of them in particular has got an amazing facility herself. One is a coach who works for me. It's, you know, there's a lot of people out there. I think when you've learned what it is to recover, then you're called to serve. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's incredible. And it must be so lovely for you as well to be able to see that progress, to see, you know, see somebody in the depths of an eating disorder and now thriving.
It makes me so proud and so excited when they do. I'm like, when they do anything, it's kind of incredible. But I think, yeah, when they're called back to kind of nurture people who are where they once were, it's really incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading through your Instagram, it might be in your website, and one other thing that I wanted to ask you about was you mentioned sort of unwell versus a well voice in trauma. And I just wanted to ask you a bit more about like what your explanation behind that would be.
I think like we have various different thoughts, and it's easiest, I feel, particularly with eating disorders, to almost categorize them into well and unwell thoughts. So an unwell thought is something that causes you to harm yourself emotionally or physically. And a well thought is something that calls you to nurture yourself in some way. So a voice that tells you to restrict, purge or binge is coming from the unwell voice that we don't trust anymore. We come to not trust. And a voice that tells you to call your friend or get some support or distract or whatever it is coming from a more nurturing place. And I think with time, you can sort of learn the difference of what they sound like and learn how to trust what's coming from a nurturing place and what isn't. And, you know, it can be sneaky, that unwell voice. It can present things to you in a way that you go, oh, that's good for me if I do that. And actually, it just takes a bit of practice of following thoughts through or talking about them with someone else and seeing what the outcome would be if you listen to it. But essentially, when you're in the throes of an eating disorder, the unwell voice is masterful. So it's calling all the shots. And what we try and do in recovery is to strengthen a more nurturing, compassionate narrative that then takes charge, essentially.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, how kind of when you're in that depth of the eating disorder, that unwell voice can mask itself as the one that's trying to look after you, and that well voice is actually the bad guy. It's an interesting shift. And then through recovery, learning.
Yeah. That's why it's useful to have, not try and do it on your own. Mm-hmm. Have someone else you can share it with, because sometimes when people reflect things back to you, it helps you to see things a little bit more clearly. Yeah, and just a bit of practice of learning what it sounds like, what it doesn't sound like, can be helpful.
Yeah, definitely. I guess a question would be, you know, in recovery and when you're, you know, years on from that eating disorder, the unwell voice might pop up. I'm sure it pops up, and then you're able to say, actually, I'm not going to do that because that's not positive for me. But, you know, if somebody starts to notice that unwell voice becoming more and more apparent and being more sneaky, how would you suggest somebody to navigate that?
I mean, first of all, get some support if you find that you're feeling a bit vulnerable to becoming unwell, but really focus your attention on what you want, not what you don't want. So think about upping your self-care, think about being extra kind to yourself. If you're feeling, and this is true for any of us at any point, you know, if you're struggling with something, then you need to pull your support around you, give yourself more of what you need. And I think what we tend to do is focus our attention on what we're resisting, what we're finding difficult, rather than thinking, actually, I really need to take care of myself even more because I've had a couple of thoughts that I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable with, and I'm going to share those with my therapist or my friend. I'm going to let them know that, you know, I just want to be accountable a little bit to some of these self-care things that I'm going to initiate. And yeah.
I think you've knocked the nail on the head there, sort of not making yourself feel bad for having those thoughts, and instead acknowledging them and maybe saying them out loud to somebody, or working on, okay, what can I do from my well voice that will make me feel better? Because I know that this unwell voice is coming from a bad place.
Yeah, the more you give that unwell voice space and attention and focus, the more powerful it becomes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. And I think, you know, I feel like this episode is going to be so helpful for people really thinking about things like trauma. And I think the thing that really stood out for me was not thinking that trauma has to be such a big, you know, event. It can be something small, and they can be life-changing, but actually thinking about what that's made you rather than the event itself. So thank you so much for that insight.
Yeah, you're so welcome.
So where can people find you to find out more information about you and more tips and everything?
You can find information about me at emmybrunner.com. And on that website, it gives you information about all the projects I run, all about my coaching, about the therapy teams that we have, and any resources that you might need, you can find there.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Emmy. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe.
Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.